This Christmas, I want to talk about vision. If you weren't aware, I've been talking about character. Last week I talked about courage. This week I want to talk about vision. And the reason I want to talk about vision on Christmas in particular is because I think that Christmas really showed an extreme vision that really only God was able to conjure up. And there's lots of different things that come to mind when we talk about vision, isn't it? It's kind of a confusing thing. I remember being in class and we would talk about vision and what vision meant. And no, Andrew, I'm not talking about the comic book superhero. But the most obvious definition of when we think about vision is our ability to see. And really, that's kind of a part of it, but it's not really what I'm getting at, right? I'm not talking about perceiving the world around us in a spectrum of light that, you know, only our eyes can comprehend. Instead, what I want to talk about is I'm talking about this character trait, and it's more akin to imagination than it is to our ability to see, right? It's our ability to think and imagine and envision what the future will hold. The definition that I'm going to be working with is literally a mental image of what the future could be like, will or could be like. Now, it's important information to have, right? We need to understand each other when we're talking. So when I'm saying vision, I don't want you to think I'm talking about my ability to see or I'm talking about any sort of weird comic book hero. I'm actually talking about, when I talk about vision today, I'm talking about the ability to look into the future, to look at the future, and to imagine what that will be like or could be like. So firstly, I want to talk about why I think vision is important, right? Because, I mean, unless it's important, really, why would you spend so much time thinking about it? Why would you spend a lot of time talking about anything like that? Why is vision a valuable tool when it comes to leadership in any capacity, whether you're in a business or you're in a church or you're even at home leading your family? Why is vision an important character trait? See, because here's the thing. There's not a single verse in the Bible that I have found that says, "And thou shalt use their vision and be thine visionary leader." Doesn't say that, ever. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about it in that way. But the fact is that what happens is as we read about these leaders, as we read about these revolutionary people that caused some amazing things to happen or are part of some amazing things, what we're seeing is that they were successful because of their vision. They were able to look at the future and seeing that things could be better, or we didn't have to live this way anymore, and they decided we are going to go start striding towards the future, and we're going to take this possibility and we're going to make it a reality. But in order to take that possibility and make the reality, you first need vision. You need to be able to see where it is you're going. The beauty of all this thing is, that people with vision understand why, you know, you need it. And as I explained before, it's really a lot like imagination, right? And we need to use our imagination in order to really capture vision, right? Because if you don't have a strong imagination, you're not able to see things better than they are or different than they are. So imagination, and I feel like imagination gets a bad rap because often when we think about imagination, we don't think of creativity. We don't think of alternate possibilities. We often think of, you know, superheroes flying in the sky and all this other stuff. No, well, there's so much more to imagination than just that stuff. And it's so important. So I have a situation. I said, imagine what would happen if instead of someone receiving a compliment towards their mother's casserole, they instead received a threat towards their mother themselves. Right? So imagine what would happen. And they said something like, your mother's casserole was so delicious, it would be a shame if something were to happen to her. See, communication is really, really important when we're talking about things. Even though the Bible does not expressly say this is the vision that was happening or this is the vision of the future here, what we need to understand is that we can extrapolate meaning. So I did that really confusingly, but we can extrapolate meaning from words and from sentences. So if someone were to say to you, your mother's casserole is delicious, it's a shame if something were to happen to her, it can be perceived as a threat. What do you mean it's a shame if something were to happen to her? It was never outrightly said, but we can understand that this is what was meant based on what was said. And so that's how we understand vision as well when we're reading the Bible. we can understand, yeah, maybe they didn't say, this is what I'm hoping for, this is what I'm dreaming of, this is where I want us to go. But we can understand when we read the Bible that they in fact did have these visions. They did have these dreams, this imagination to take them where they needed to go. And you need to have a good vision, you need to have great imagination. So the first example I want to talk about is in Genesis 1, 1 to 2. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering above the waters. Most people out here have probably heard that. I mean, I feel like even non-Christians have heard that because it's just such a common verse that it's used time and time and time again. But I love this passage because what I imagine God seeing when he looks down at the earth, it says it was formless. It had no shape. It had nothing. And I like to think of it as just like this lump of clay sitting on a table, right? It's just it's got nothing. It has potential. It could be something, right? And someone who's an artist can come along and say, look, one of the most famous things, I think, was it Michelangelo? He used to say he would stare at a pillar of marble, and he would just sit there and stare at it. And he would say it wasn't that he was carving something into the marble, but that he was removing the pieces that didn't belong, right? Because he could envision what was supposed to be there. And so what I see when God is looking here at the earth, he sees this lumpless form, this useless piece of rock that's just sitting there, and he says, look, I can see something amazing here. Most of us would have seen a blob of worthless dirt. It's taking up space. It's even taking up our time just to look at it. We're like, what is this? It's garbage. But to someone with vision and imagination, much like Michelangelo, they look at it and they see something beautiful. They see something wonderful. They see what it could be. But you need to put a little time and effort into that. God looked at this desolate place, and instead of seeing something worthless like dirt, he instead had a vision of what it could become and all the life that could happen and all these different things that he ended up creating. God shows us vision in this time, and it was unlike anything that we had ever seen before. And he takes essentially nothing and he makes something. And from the beginning, vision was something that was really something we had a really big need for. And it's a big need for the decisions that we're going to make and for the things that we're going to see next in our lives. And the next big vision, it happened shortly after this, and it's in Genesis 3:15. And so what happened is, we know the story, Adam and Eve, they go to eat the fruit of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. And while this is happening, God finds out, and he asks them all these questions, and they lie about it, and then eventually they just blame the snake. And so this is God finally passing down his judgment, and he said to the snake, and he says, I put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. Many people have probably heard that. And for those of you who've been a Christian for a long time, you've probably heard it referenced to as it's the first time that we see Jesus being predicted. It's the first time we see this case where God's saying, look, I'm going to send the Son of Man to take care of all the evil. I'm going to send the Son of Man. He's going to take care of the evil of this world, which was represented by the snake that brought evil into the world. And it was right at the beginning that we see this. Like, but before anything else was forecast, before anything else was said, before all kingdoms formed, before we started developing more complex technologies, any of this, we started. The first thing we see is, look, there's a problem with this world, but I'm going to solve it. I'm going to send my son. And of course, Eve, right away, she believed it so much that when her first son arrives, Cain, she believes, oh, this must be the Son of Man. And in fact, if you read the passage that immediately follows the birth of Cain, you get the feeling that she really did think that this was the son that she was waiting for, the one that was going to redeem them. Of course, we end up realizing that this pattern was going to repeat itself over and over again. Many people would have sons and they would think, oh, this is going to be the one. No, this is going to be the one. In fact, there's a reason why when Jesus eventually did arrive, people didn't believe him because they had heard it so many times, right? They heard that boy cry wolf so many times. They just, yeah, you're the Messiah. Yeah, so was Tom last week. They just didn't believe it anymore. And there's even people today that claim that they give birth to Jesus or claim that they are Jesus. You know, we still see these claims today. because there's this deep thing inside of us where each and every one of us know that there is something wrong. Something is not right. We need to put something right in the world. But those people don't understand that someone did come and put it right. And that's what we're celebrating this morning. As a result, of course, there are so many different religions that have popped up as a result, right? There's this deep inborn thing that says there's something wrong, and so we form religious beliefs to try and to deal with it. And really, if you look at it, Judaism and Christianity, they aren't that old, right? Judaism didn't actually find its roots until after the slaves were freed from Egypt. And then, of course, they began they built the temple, and then, of course, Judaism began. But before that, there was nothing. They just believed in God. And so when other people say, oh, well, these religions are so much older. Well, yeah, they're older because they were trying to find a way to articulate something that they knew was wrong on the inside. And God hadn't created his light into the world yet, which, by the way, was what Israel was meant to be. See, Buddhism was created for a man looking for nirvana. He wanted to reach this end of suffering. He knew that suffering was a result of something that we did. It was something bad, but he didn't know what it was, and so he came up with this idea of nirvana, the end of suffering. And then Islam, which was wrote down by someone who was illiterate, was a way of trying to resolve their problems. And Mormonism, by another man who had a vision from an angel. But all these religions were just ways of trying to deal with this problem that we knew we had. And the worst part is that they don't even offer the hope that we have because they don't know the truth. They're still looking for their answers. I mean, the fact that this was always the craziest thing to me with Buddhism, the whole point was that Buddha reached nirvana, so he ended suffering, so he ended the cycle of rebirth. But we have the Dalai Lama, who is the reincarnation of Buddha, which means that he never did. So, poor guy, he's tortured. But the fact is that vision is the thing that compels us, and we love it because it helps us to look to the future and see, look, things could be better, right? That's why people get into religion in the first place. They say something is wrong, and this is trying to offer me hope for the future. See, the thing is that we need to, and so we fall into these religions, and we're looking for truth. We're looking for answers for why everything is wrong. And honestly, that was exactly what set me on my path of trying to find truth. I remember when I was in high school, I was looking at all kinds of different religions and all kinds of different ways to try and find truth. And what I noticed was a lot of religions had a lot of unanswered questions, because Christianity was so arrogant that they said they had it all, but because the rest of them were just like, there's still something missing. And we've created this code and this creed, and this is a good way to live, and this is a great way to do life, but, for example, in Islam, you may or may not get into heaven. With case of Jehovah's Witnesses, well, there's only room for so many, so you better get your points up. Mormons get their own planet, but that's a totally other different thing. So we can talk about that another time. But the thing is that it's hard for us to see ourselves in a future that's horrible, right? We don't like that. We want to imagine that we can make things better. Right, when we have kids, we want to have a better life for our kids. And so we dream it up. We imagine what it could be. Vision is what allows us to do this, and that's a good character trait that we need to foster. It's something that we need to let grow in our lives. Because if you don't have vision, you're never going to grow. And you're just going to be stunted for the rest of your life. God had vision when he first seen that, there's going to be this struggle between good and evil. It's going to be the struggle between the Son of Man, Jesus, and the devil. It's not really a struggle, but it's a struggle. But truth can hold up to interrogation. So we need to remember that when we're going through and we're looking for our truth, we just need to sift through everything. Because guess what? Truth can stand up to facts, because it's always true. True is true is true. Sometimes, and you might have heard this because it's becoming this more common thing, but like truth is relative. No, it's not. Because truth is either true or it's not true. And it can either hold up to interrogation and questioning, or it can't. But truth will. Another example I have, this is the last one from Genesis, I swear. is from Genesis 12, 1 to 4. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, your father's household, your land, and I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you. So Abram went as the Lord had told him. Okay, so Abram, later called Abraham, we love this guy, don't we? He's the father of what will become the nation of Israel. And really, he became the father of Christianity, because if it wasn't for him, the nation of Israel wouldn't have existed. And if it wasn't for the nation of Israel, Jesus wouldn't have been born. And if it hadn't have been for Jesus coming into the land of the Jews, where all the work had been prepared and everything was ready, there would not have been the explosion of the church. Really, this shows the extreme vision that God had. He was able to see into the future, and he knew exactly what he needed to do and have done. And so we love Abraham when we look back at him, because he was obedient. He did something. But the thing, one of the things I'd like to talk about with Abraham is that, you know, Abraham wasn't just some normal guy. He wasn't some working class guy. He was a very wealthy guy. He was a very successful man. Right? In his land, where he was in the city of Ur, he had been doing very, very well. He was obedient to God, of course, and he had done very well. And then God comes and says, I have a proposition for you. I want you to go to this land. I want you to leave your country and go off to a place you've never been before. I want you to go to a place where they don't even talk about me anymore. I want you to go there, and when you get there, I'm going to make sure that you have so many kids, so many descendants, that you will be a nation one day. Now, Abraham had a choice to make, and we don't often talk about his choice, because it just says, and then he left. That's amazing, first off, because oftentimes we like to talk about it as if he did it out of blind obedience. God said something, you know, God said jump, he said okay, and he started jumping. No. One of the things I like to remind people is that just because it doesn't say something happened doesn't mean it didn't happen. In other words, it doesn't say that Jesus took a pee in the Bible. I'm pretty sure he did. But the fact is that, you know, we have to be willing to understand that there are certain kinds of behavior that would have stood out to people. Therefore, that was noteworthy. We should write that down. Hey, you know, this isn't normal. But kind of normal, common, everyday behavior, we kind of presuppose that, yeah, that happened. And so whenever someone's offered something, you know, I don't think that Abraham just went, okay, let's do it. I'm pretty sure he sat there and he weighed his options. He thought about it, thought about the future. What would happen if I obeyed God in this situation? What would happen if I did leave? The thing is that he understood, and, you know, he was a really smart guy. He was really wealthy. It meant he knew how to, you know, conduct himself. He knew how to be successful. And I'm sure this meant that he had vision as well. He was able to think of the future and what would be best for his offspring. What would be best for my ancestors? Or for my descendants, not ancestors. It doesn't matter to them, they're dead. And so one of the things I'm sure he came to is that, hey, first off, this is a pretty big honor. God could have gone to anyone on this earth, and instead he came to me. Point number one. The other thing is that he looked at the future, he saw what could happen. He realized, you know, he would be responsible for the birth of a nation, and eventually, this nation was, as God promoted it, was going to be a light to the world, that people would come to know about the goodness and the love of God through his family. That's a pretty big deal that God is offering him and laying him right there. And I'm sure that Abraham didn't just go, yep, I'm sure he thought, you know what, this is such a good thing. This is such an amazing thing. He looked toward the future and realized the potential that this had. And of course, he does leave, and his legacy begins to grow, and it becomes the nation of Israel. And then eventually they do become slaves to Egypt. Moses comes, frees them, and another great visionary appears amongst these people. And we read about this visionary, Moses, in Numbers chapter 13, 26 to 30. Or sorry, no, not Moses, but you're going to hear about him. And then it says, they came back to Moses and Aaron, the whole Israelite community at Kadesh, in the desert of Paran. They reported to them that the whole and to the whole assembly, and showed them the fruit of the land. So this is when the spies went into the land, the promised land, and they said, "Hey, you know what is there?" And it says, "We went into the land in which you sent us. It does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit." And if you remember, it said they brought back one cluster of grapes that took two men to carry. But the people who live there are powerful. and the cities are fortified, very large. We even saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, they live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." Caleb, why do I keep saying Moses? Caleb, he's one of my favorite people that I've ever read about in the Bible. I love the story of Caleb. So Caleb was, not only was he the leader of this particular tribe of Israel, not only was he selected, but he had the faith and he had the vision to look at the future that lay before them. There they are standing on the edge of the promised land. All they have to do is go in and take it. And God says, "I'm going to give it to you. Not only are you going to be able to take it, but you're going to be able to take it easily." Caleb sees this. He sees what's happening, and you know, and he sees what's the ability that, or not the ability, but the, but he sees the promise that they have. He sees what they could have. He understands that God has led them through so much. He was there when Egypt had judgment called down on it. He watched the plagues of Egypt as that came down. He watched what God did as he parted the Red Sea. He watched what God did when they were at the mountain and he descended as a cloud. And he watched what God did when the people began worshiping the idol. He knew who God was. That was check one. So then having that knowledge of God, he was able to take a look at all the obstacles that lay ahead of them. He had the vision and the imagination. He had the creativity. He understood what was happening, who was on their side, and he could see what lay before them. He could see the victory. He could see the success. He could see all of that promise coming together. He understood that there was some challenge, but he was not so naive. He had integrity and he knew he needed to stand up for something. In the face of overwhelming odds, Caleb believed and went forward towards the truth. Unfortunately, not all people have the same convictions that Caleb have. And as a result, they couldn't grab hold of that vision. And this happens too. You see this today. When people can't get hold of that vision, they don't understand what you're trying to work for. Right? You see it in business. When you bring your team together, things just fall apart. You know, investors back out. Things happen. Why? Because vision can be hard. Sometimes doubt and misery can be good motivators too, though. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, 32 to 37, David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on the account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." So this is David standing before the king as Goliath is standing on the opposite ridge mocking them. Saul replied, "You are not able to go against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he is a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God, the Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." See, when David looked across the battlefield and he seen this giant, seen this big behemoth man who had been fighting since he was a kid, I mean, all he could see is that the Hebrew people were giving in. They were submitting to this monster. These chosen people of God, who God promised victory to, were saying, "This guy is too scary." They were giving up. They allowed themselves to be controlled by fear. And we see this still today. People try and use fear to control us and control others all the time. Because it's powerful. It gets to us. But David knew what could become of them if he didn't allow it to continue. He said, "Look, if we take this guy down, there's nothing's going to stop us. If this guy falls down, if this guy is struck down, then that's going to rile up everyone and say, what were we afraid of?" David didn't like what he saw on the other side of the ridge. So he walked forward in the field of battle. He didn't even wear armor. Right? It says that Saul offered him his armor and he said, "No, it's too bulky. It doesn't fit. I don't like it. Look, I'm just going to go like this." So he walks forward. He was a dreamer, and he knew that there was a better way than just giving in to the monster in his life. You know, and we all have those monsters in our lives that are always trying to control us and intimidate us and you know, cause us to fear. I'm not saying strike them in the head with a stone. Okay, let's just get it over with. But we do need to confront them. But instead, he picked up his sling, he walked towards this beast of a man, he struck him in the head. And then, as the ultimate insult to injury, takes Goliath's sword and cuts off his own head. Then he holds it up for both armies to see and says, "What's so scary about this guy now?" So what ends up happening? The armies of Israel get all riled up. They realize, wait a minute, why were we letting this fear control us? We could have something so much better. They get all riled up, and of course they charge the field and they drive the Philistines away. See, the future, part of vision is being able to see the future so that we realize, you know what, we need to be able to stand up to the bully. You know, we don't need to live in torment. We don't need to live in fear. Vision saved the day. And so, and you say, yeah, but what about incomplete vision, right? So sometimes you have a great vision of the future, you have a great idea, but, you know, sometimes it doesn't always follow through. And the Bible gives us a good example of that as well. In 2 Kings chapter 10, 18, 19, it says, "And Jehu brought all the people together and said to them, 'Ahab served Baal a little, Jehu will serve him much. Now summon all the prophets of Baal and all of his servants and priests. See that no one is missing, because I'm going to hold a great sacrifice to Baal. Anyone that fails to come will no longer live.' But Jehu was acting deceptively in order to destroy the servants of Baal." Then later on in the story, in 25 to 28, we read this. "As soon as Jehu had finished making the burnt offering, he ordered the guards and officers, 'Go in and kill them, let no one escape.' So they cut down with the sword the guards and the officers, threw the bodies out, and entered the inner shrine of the temple of Baal. They brought out the sacred stone of the temple of Baal and burned it. They demolished the sacred stone of Baal, and they tore down the temple of Baal, and the people have used it as a latrine to this day. So Jehu destroyed Baal worship in Israel." So at this time, by the way, Israel is two nations. We have the northern nation of Israel and the southern nation of Judea. And so what happened here was, after the nation split, the ones that lived in the northern country, they realized, well, the temple is down in Jerusalem, in Judea. Well, you know, if we give in and we, you know, go worship at the temple, then, you know, we need to give up really our own identity. So instead, they set up two golden calves and to go worship God. And then what ended up happening after that is, well, you know, you make one compromise, you start making another and another and another. And then all of a sudden, all of this Baal worship and Asherah worship was happening all over. And Jehu came along, and he was a king, and he said, "Look, we used to have it so good. We did so well. You know what the problem was? We started worshiping idols. I know it's good. Let's get rid of them." The problem was that his vision wasn't complete. Right? He thought, you know what? I know what we need to do. I need to get rid of idols, but I want to get rid of all but the ones that, you know, were our original ones. I want to get rid of all except for the two golden calves that we had set up. He destroyed all the idols. He was doing such a good job at trying to get back to purity, at, you know, getting back to where they started. But what happening was is, you know, he allowed his pride to keep him from fully realizing the vision. Sometimes we do this in our lives as well. You know, we want to do these amazing things. We have these great objectives in mind, and we start pursuing them with all that we have. But the problem is that, you know, we get so far and we think, yeah, but that's going to, you know, that's going to insinuate that I have to change, or that's going to insinuate that I'm doing something wrong. So I don't want to do that. And so instead, then we end up slipping up, and then the same mistakes happen over and over and over again. And that's exactly what happened here. Jehu had the potential to be the first good king in a very long line of bad kings. And instead, he was a bad king. He continued this divide, and because his vision was only good if he continued to act on it. He didn't see it through. He didn't see through the destruction of all idols. He just destroyed a bunch and then thought, well, you know, I've done enough. But we need to continue to pursue even after our victories. Imagine how World War II would have been different if at the victory of Normandy, they would have just stood around and high-fived each other. Yeah, great job, guys. We did it. But they didn't push in. They didn't keep going all through France and then push in towards Germany and push in to end it. They would have just sat there on the beaches of Normandy and thought, yeah, we did it. You know, they said it was impossible, but we did it. I mean, we would have been reading a very, very different war. Our history would be very, very different. The fact is that the men and women that were involved in this war, they realized, look, we can't just stop. If we want to end this, we need to push on no matter how hard it is, no matter how difficult it becomes. And they did, and they pushed through, and that's why we read the history we have today. That's why there is victory we have today. And God, of course, had such vision. In John 3:16, he said this, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." And this is what I wanted to bring around to. This is what Christmas is about. See, God knew that it was going to take more than just Christmas Day as well, right? He knew that it was going to take more than Jesus just being born here. But it marks the beginning of the battle. It was the invasion of Normandy. On the first Christmas, that battle began, and in fact, people were trying to kill Jesus ever since he was born, even before he was born, right? The wise men go to Herod, and they say, he's like, oh, you know, he acts deceitfully and says, let me know where when you find him so I can go worship him, but really he wanted to kill him, even before he was born. See, and of course, Jesus' parents had to flee to Egypt to be safe. Now, this Advent season that we've just gone through, it represents the vision that God had for us. He said, you know what? I want to make things right. I want to have a good relationship. I want to be able to be with my people once again. But the only way I'm going to be able to do that is I got to make an invasion. And he did. Came on Christmas. And he began that process. He began that journey. He started that fight for us. He loved us so much that he sent his only son on Christmas so that it could be fought. He didn't have to fight this battle, but he chose to do it. He wanted it to be done so that souls could be won and he could have victory for the faithful. So we need to realize that today is more than just a holiday where we get to have fun with family, open some presents, have turkey, have an early nap because we ate too much. We need to understand what Jesus understood all those years ago, what God understood all those years ago. Today we celebrate the beginning of something that's still happening. We celebrate the beginning of the war for souls. We celebrate not just the birth of our Savior, but of salvation itself. Salvation began because Jesus came and was born on Christmas Day. We celebrate because someone loved us so much that they were willing to come be born and die to save us. So let us remember the real meaning of Christmas as we go home and we share time with our families today. Let us remember that, you know, let us love each other, build each other up, encourage one another as a church family. And hopefully they're listening to this on the podcast and they're going to continue to do that too. Let's help each other become visionaries to see the future and grab a hold of that future with each other. Because that's just one more mark of extremely godly character. Be able to see the future that God has planned for us. Be able to jump on and grab a hold of that.